People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions.
Hello, I'm Chris Nicklin, and our guest on People of Note this week is the greatest active playwright in the English-speaking world. For a South African who describes himself as an Afrikaner writing in the English language, that's some acknowledgement. I'm speaking, of course, about Ethel Fugard, whose sequence of plays, essentially about man's inhumanity to man, are firmly rooted in this beloved but bewildering country of ours. A consummate man of the theatre, never content to confine himself to pen and paper, he's also directed most of his plays. He was the first non-American to receive a Tony Lifetime Achievement Award from what's regarded as the most prestigious prize-giving body in the theatre world. Now he's back in Cape Town for the run of his new play, The Painted Rocks at Revolver Creek. Ethel Fugard, welcome to People of Note.
Thank you, Chris. Delighted to be here.
Ethel, I say a new play, but I believe Revolver Creek was something you first started writing in 2010 and then abandoned for a few years before picking up on it again.
That's correct. I came across the name of this remarkable outsider artist, to, you know, that's the category in which he is now slotted together with Helen Martins of New Bethesda. Mm-hmm. I first came across him when a friend happened to mention his amazing achievement up in Mpumalanga somewhere, of a man who had painted the rocks, or just about all the rocks, of a little kopje. And a little bit of research led me online to a website which was... and I owe so much to that man for that website. An artist by the name of Clark. I forget what his first name is. John Clark, maybe? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a J, I know. And a few very basic details about the life of this African gentleman who had painted the rocks. And I was struck by it immediately and felt that there was a story there somewhere, and started to make notes and think about it, which is my usual process before leading to a play.
Why did he paint these rocks?
Nobody knows. Nobody knows. I mean, I, in my play, ascribe it to a sort of vision he had, looking up at a rainbow one day, and he just... wanted to have a garden of flowers, as he put it, in his own words. And
so the play is based in truth, as so many of your other plays are?
Yes, but I've taken all the liberties that go with, all the poetic licenses that go with writing a play on my side. It is not a documentary. Mm. The man's life, as I've now gone on to discover, was very different to the life of the character I've created on stage.
Sure.
So, but I mean, I owe everything to the original man, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How often have you stopped working on a play for whatever reason, only to revive it sometime later?
Interesting that you ask that, Chris, because that is very much the story of Master Harold and the Boys.
Yes.
Because for the longest time, you know, in my childhood, my two greatest friends were the two African men who worked for my family as waiters in the boarding house we first had, and then in the little tea room. And they were so important in making me the man I am, or for better or for worse, that I've always felt I must somehow do something about them, for them. And for the longest time, Chris, my notebooks reflect an attempt, yet another attempt, to write a two-hander for these two men. Mm-hmm. My play was just two characters, and it never really worked. And then one day, I suddenly saw myself as the little early teenager that I was in the company of these two men in the tea room on a rainy afternoon, and the whole play came to life, and I wrote it virtually. I had to stop halfway through because I had to go to India to join Attenborough and his making of the film Gandhi. Mm-hmm. But when I got back, there it was, and I completed it.
Mm. Because it was only in the 80s that you actually completed it, as you say, and you, by that point, you'd been writing for a couple of decades.
Yes, exactly, absolutely. And the same with The Painted Rocks at Revolver Creek. that there was this earlier attempt, but it turned out to be a one actor. That early draft was of a one act play, mm-hmm. with just the two characters, the old man and the little boy who was his helper. And I put it away. I put it in the bottom drawer, the famous bottom drawer that all writers have. And then I can't quite remember what brought it to life for me again. Oh, I know what it was. It was actually the whole situation that this country is still dealing with now, which is farm murders, mm-hmm. and the claim by some Afrikaners that it is a deliberate campaign to drive the Afrikaner off his land, etc., etc. And I suddenly saw a potential for a second act which dealt with this coming out of the first act. And lo and behold, there it is.
And Athol, is it accurate to say that your writing demonstrates a fascination with people living on the edge, people in desperate situations, or was that just too glib?
No, that's the best definition of most of the characters I've created. Mm-hmm. People living, as you put it, Chris, on the edge, desperate. My stories, the stories of my play, all come out of desperate men and women in desperate situations.
Athol, time to hear what you've chosen as your first piece of music.
Oh, the Richter playing Schumann's Fantasia, Opus 17. You know, my dad was a pianist, and I think that explains my absolute love of piano music. For me, that is, my dad once told me then when I said that, this is the king of instruments, Dad, and he said, no, the violin is that. But I love the piano, and as you can see, I think there's another keyboard piece in my selection which comes up later, I suppose.
Well, let's take a listen to this one now.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
The great Russian pianist Vyacheslav Richter playing Schumann's Fantasy Opus 17, the choice of our guest and people of note, Athol Fugard. Athol, Time magazine described you as the most performed English language playwright after Shakespeare. How have you managed to ensure that the almost exclusive South African context of your plays has not limited their international appeal?
You know, that's a question that's come up quite a few times in my writing life, and I don't know. I can't explain it. Well, you know, with the same interest or satisfaction that I have in reading the short stories of Russian writers, French writers, obviously in translation in both cases, but the same fascination I have with stories about people. It's just stories about people. And
so is it just powerful storytelling then, no matter how parochial the subject?
I think it's as simple as that. It is actually as simple as that. A great friend of mine, and dead now, but certainly legendary in theatre in our country, Barney Simon, once told me that God created man because he likes listening to stories. And, you know, That's a bit of Jewish wisdom that I think explains a lot, and I like to remember that quote.
At the time you contemplated becoming a playwright in the late 1950s, there was little on offer in South Africa apart from warmed-up West End hits. I'm trying to imagine how you saw a possible career in writing plays, or did you spot a gap in the market, as they say?
Neither. I just had a compulsion to tell stories. I just wanted to sit down and write. And I must admit, there was also, at that very early stage in my life, a degree already of outrage at what was happening, because this was just prior to the start of official apartheid, and I had already then sort of identified and felt that I was a writer and that I wanted to tell stories. But even then already, thanks to an incredible mother that I had, I realized that something was wrong in the state of Denmark and that my anger, my sense of urgency about the situation, the need and desire to bear witness to what was happening to fellow South Africans has persisted to this day.
I do understand that your mother was a very powerful influence in your life, the family breadwinner, but she was also semi-literate. There's an irony there that her son should become such a famous man of words, isn't it?
I know, and I didn't know, but God just gave her a heart that was so free of prejudice and an intelligence that made her look around at the world in which I was growing up, and saying to me, I can remember very clearly one day saying to me, you know, Hallie, that was my nickname in my childhood, short for Harold. You know, Hallie, there's something wrong in this country. It's not right. It's not the way it should be. I remember that very clearly.
And Athol, your first wife, Sheila, whom you met here in Cape Town, she was an actress, and it seems that your life in the theatre was really given impetus by this relationship.
Yes, that's right. It certainly was. It certainly was. You know, and Sheila didn't persist in trying to make a career out of acting, because she had a very considerable literary gift as well. Mm-hmm. And she now lives in San Diego in Southern California with my daughter and grandson. But she has published three novels, poetry. Now, you know, but certainly at that early point in my life, she gave my desire to pursue a career in theatre a lot of impetus.
Athol, time for another music break. Can we have your second track, please?
Oh, this is Arvo Pärt's Spiegel im Spiegel. I hope I've pronounced that correctly.
I think that's right.
And it reflects his fascination with religious chant, and in this particular case, Gregorian chant. And I know that I also find it music, that Gregorian chant, something I've listened to time and time and time again. And Paulie, my wife, and I were recently in Japan, And we had the very great privilege of meeting him there and thanking him for his music, because we've listened to just about everything else he's written.
Spiegel im Spiegel, written for single piano and violin by the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, one of Athol Fugard's favourite pieces of music. Athol, it was the racially charged play The Blood Knot, written in 1961, that really seemed to launch you as an internationally known playwright. Why do you think that play had such profound impact?
Well, I think it dealt with an issue that was and still is very alive in America. The issue of racialism, of underprivileged black and privileged white, is something that America is still very much entangled in. I mean, you only have to watch the shenanigans of Donald Trump on television.
Shenanigans is the right word.
Yeah, wow. I mean, it's almost impossible to really believe that a nation with such profound human resources, you know, wealth of human resources, beautiful men, beautiful women, you know, intelligent, big hearts, can just throw up a candidate like Donald Trump.
A leadership deficit almost there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But just going back to Blood Knot, Athol, you say it's the, or you identify it as the play where you found your voice for the first time. Yes. As a playwright.
Yes, I found my voice, and the size of my canvas, you know, well, you're kind of mixing metaphors there, you know, but it certainly found my voice is the right word, and also the size and scope of my plays. I'm a miniaturist, let's face it. My canvases are small. I would never attempt anything like, who can I think of? A Brecht, for example, who has a vast canvas, you know, in some of his big plays. I can't do that. I think I've made one or two attempts, but fortunately they never saw the light of day. But when it comes to that small canvas and two, three, at the most a crowd, as far as I'm concerned, of four actors, I'm at home.
Apparently you get quite peeved when journalists ask you what people should take away from your plays, so I'm not going to ask you that. What I would like to know, though, is did your plays become increasingly political because of the deteriorating situation in South Africa?
Well, I don't think they've become increasingly political. I think that people's awareness of the issues that I try to bear witness to, or the situations I try to bear witness to in my plays, I believe that just the awareness that my plays focus on that sort of thing is what has grown. I can't think of myself as being more political. Though maybe I am, you know, it's very hard, Chris, because I'm not really a good analyst of myself and what has happened to my writing. I'm going to leave that to the scholars and the academics and the critics.
How did your collaboration with black actors like Zex Mokwai and John Carney happen? Because it was technically illegal for whites and blacks to appear on the same stage.
Yeah. One of my proudest moments was when Zex finally stood on stage in New York and received his Tony Award for playing Sam in Master Harold and the Boys, which is the play I'm going to be reviving in a few weeks' time in New York. How did I meet Sam? There came a point in my career, you know, I started off being a freelance journalist for a couple of newspapers in Port Elizabeth, my career. I was writing short stories and poetry and that sort of thing. And then I met Sheila, and suddenly my interest in theatre was sparked and has never dimmed and turned into a blaze which still burns brightly inside me. And I was transferred. I joined the SABC as a journalist. I was transferred to Cape Town. And somehow I had a sense, and I think to a certain extent it's still true. You know, the first Prime Minister of South Africa with a nationalist Afrikaner government, was D.F. Malan, and he's quoted as having once said, South Africa begins at the Cape Flats, you know. Gee. And to a certain extent, that's true. On our drive to you this morning, Chris, you know, passing through that Sea Point beachfront with these colossal blocks of flats, you realize that, you know, it's a very privileged minority that enjoys all of this. So, yeah, I think the South African situation has sharpened and I've become more aware of it. And it's hard to believe that at this point, almost two decades after Nelson Mandela, or yes, more than two decades after Nelson Mandela stepped out of jail, Paulsmoor Prison, hard to believe that we are still enmeshed in the struggle of racial prejudice and what have you, haves and have-nots.
Yeah. Ethel, I'm just interested to know how you managed to engineer the situation on the stage in South Africa in the 60s in order to appear with fellow black actors.
Well, I'm just trying to remember. I'm trying to remember my friendship.
You appeared on stage with him in The Blood Knot, and that was the first time that a black actor and a white actor appeared on stage together in South Africa.
Yes, and that was before the formulation of the Group Areas Act, which made that impossible, because then it was a question of a theatre being zoned for whites' occupation and all of that. But there was a loophole which I eventually began to exploit, and which was certainly the case in terms of my work with John Carney and Winston and Chawner. There was a loophole that if the venue was listed as private and everybody who came along to that venue had specifically been invited, you could mix your audience and you could mix your cast on stage. And that is how Sizwe Bonzi is dead and the island both enjoyed their first life in South Africa.
On reflection, it sounds almost ludicrous now, but some more music, Athol. What's your third piece?
My third piece is Sophie Yates playing one of these suites from Handel keyboard work. It's Passacaglia in G minor. I've often wished I could find a theatre form that would give me what Theme and Variations gives a musician, which is to have one simple statement of a melody and then to be able to play with that recognizably the same melody, but to take it through all sorts of transformations. And this is one of my favorite examples of Theme and Variations as Passacaglia.
Let's take a listen to it then.
Thank you.
The English harpsichord is Sophie Yates with Handel's Passacaglia, the choice of Ethel Fugard in today's People of Note. Ethel, we were talking about Master Harold and the Boys a little earlier, and it's often cited as your most well-known work, set in the tea room that your mother ran in Port Elizabeth. How autobiographical is it?
Very autobiographical. I think that at this point, it is the most autobiographical. You know, any writer, you or male or female, uses himself or herself as a subject matter of what they write. I don't think there's any way of escaping that, because what else do you have except your own personal experience?
I read that you say you're always in disguise in one form or another in your plays.
That's correct. And interestingly enough, Chris, when I first wrote Blood Knot, I never really saw any of its, or what are now recognized as its political resonances in terms of portraying the issue of white and black. When I first wrote it, it was a straightforward attempt to write about my brother and myself. And in order to highlight the fact that his life was, and his personality and what he wanted to do with his life and had done with his life was so different to mine, I thought, oh, South Africa's given me the perfect example of how to do that. Make him black and you'll be white.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It could have been the other way around, but that's how it came out. And but with time, I realized that the play also is a very serious look at the issue of race and racial discrimination.
Just going back to Master Harold, there's that profoundly shocking moment when Hallie, i.e. you, the 17-year-old aspiring writer with liberal pretensions, spits in the face of Sam, a black servant who is effectively Hallie's surrogate father. Did anything like that actually happen?
Yes, I did do that. To my dying day, I will confess to that as the one thing in my life I am most profoundly ashamed and still ashamed of, because there's no way I can erase it. I did it. I did it. It came out of a moment of great confusion, of anguish, of pain, precipitated by the fact that I had a father who was a beautiful man, but he was a cripple and an alcoholic. I loved him and he loved me, and that was beautiful, but he wasn't a role model, and what any boy wants is a role model, and the first role model has got to be his father. And my father wasn't my role model. Of all impossible dilemmas, my role model was Sam, the black man that worked for the family. And, you know, in the age of apartheid, to say your role model is a black man was... Oh, you know, that was unforgivable.
Mm.
But point, Chris, is you're making is that it actually happened. It came out of the specifics of that afternoon in the tea room, and it reflects how confused, how troubled a young life can be until it finally finds its way.
And writing about it so many years later?
I think it was an attempt to actually confront and deal with what I had done, to exorcise it, if you understand, mm-hmm. to exorcise my shame. But I realize now there's no escaping it. I can't. But interestingly enough, Chris, what has come to me recently is a sort of belated sequel to Master Harold and the Boys, and that is there as a possibility for something I might write in the future.
Well, I'll certainly look out for that. Ethel, you've also acted in some of your plays. When do you feel the need to take on a role?
Well, taking on the roles was something dictated by the circumstances of that I had to deal with in when I first started writing plays. I mean, if there's no white actor I could think of who would go on stage with Zakes and do Master Harold under the humiliating circumstances we had to put up with when we performed. So necessity forced me, and I think I've got a certain conceit about myself, a vanity. I know that stepping out onto a stage remains for me, because I did it again recently with The Shadow of the Hummingbird, mm-hmm. is a very thrilling experience, because it's, you know, to be able to tell a story and to capture the attention of a random group of people, your audience, and keep them with you. That's a very thrilling experience. It's a high.
You mentioned conceit, and I read recently a playwright who says he directs his own plays to protect what he writes. Does the same apply to acting in the plays that you write?
Yes, I think it does. Yes, I think that's very true. Yes, it's also to guarantee, and that's always why I direct the premieres of any of my plays. I let them go on after that and fall in, you know, other hands, be dealt with. But it is to ensure that the play I wrote, the text I wrote and which I understand, is on the stage for its birth.
We're on to your fourth piece of music, Athol. What do you have for us next, please?
Bach is the Everest of all music and all musicians, as far as I'm concerned. And I can remember that my dear friend and filmmaker Ross Devenish and I were thinking of music that might be used for that film we made about the life of Eugene Marais, The Guest, and which dealt with his drug addiction. And can't remember how I first came to listen to the cello suites, but once I'd heard them, as is the case with most of the Bach music that I cherish and love, you know, it was a love affair at first hearing. And I suggested this to Ross, and we listened to the unaccompanied cello suites, and we chose this particular number one preludium to be the sort of theme music of our movie.
Prelude for the Cello Suite No. 1, played by the French cellist Paul Tourtellier. Athol, with the advent of democracy in South Africa, you announced that you would probably be the country's first literary redundancy, since so much of your writing had been about the trauma of apartheid. What made you say that?
I just felt that, you know, based on the first utterances of Nelson Mandela, I felt that we had finally turned our backs on, you know, the evil, that apartheid world, and that we were going to just move forward. And I naively imagined that it was going to be, I knew it would be difficult to unravel all that resentment and hate and anger and frustration that we'd accumulated over the decades of apartheid and, or for that matter, the colonial period before that. But I felt we could do it and that we were going to be truly a rainbow nation.
But you thought you were going to be out of a job.
Well, yes, because, you know, I had the tools I had, I thought would no longer be of any use in shaping plays for the new world, for this new audience that was coming up.
But your continued prolific output suggests that you've managed to successfully move with the times. What are the issues that have tended to occupy you as a playwright in the post-apartheid era?
I think the issue that in the post-apartheid years, what we haven't resolved, for example, and this I know is going to be a major, major stumbling block until we get past it in our future, is the whole issue of land. Who owns the land?
Hence your new play.
Yeah, hence my new play. That's right, because The Painted Rocks at Revolver Creek has that very much at the heart of it. And that's all I can say, Chris.
What about writing something overtly political? You're on record as saying that the new complicated South Africa needs more vigilance than ever before. Would you be prepared to tackle a play that somehow captures the growing anger towards the current government and a feeling that corrupt politicians are robbing us of a promising future?
You know, I'm 84 years old as I sit here talking to you. And with age, one becomes, a lot of changes take place in. And one of the things that changes is that you actually begin to live more in terms of your inner world, your inner landscapes, than the one around you. I do not feel as connected. I mean, that might change. I do not feel as connected to this world around me at the moment as I did during those years of apartheid. And I think that's partly the result of age. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of writers then become much more introspective as time passes. And I think that's happening to me. I've got several projects that I want to work on. Paula and I are very anxious to be in our own home at our desks just writing. But none of them, with one possible exception, and there's a handful of plays I want to write, but with one exception, I think they're all about me. Mm-hmm. Let me put it that way, okay. That the subject in my plays has become me.
Time now for your final musical selection, Athold, and I'm reliably informed that it's something vastly different from what we've heard before.
Oh, yes, that it certainly is, Chris. It is Tina Charles, her recording, I believe it's a disco recording, made in 1976 of I Love to Love. And it's a piece of dance music that ends my favorite television detective series, River.
That was Tina Charles with her classic 1970s disco track, I Love to Love. And Affle, after that, I have to ask, do you love to love and love to dance?
Yes, I love both. I love to love and I love to dance.
Just before the last track, you were talking about your age, the fact that you're 84. And I'm intrigued that you've spent so much of the latter years of your life in the United States. Why?
I've earned most of my living from the work done in the United States. I always write in the very first instance for fellow South Africans. There's never been any exception to that. And I never take a play somewhere else if I have the opportunity of doing it first in South Africa. But the truth is that Americans have found that my plays sort of resonate for them because of their own conflicts. And that has made it possible for me to earn a living there.
Have you ever been tempted to turn things on its head and write a play set in the United States?
I did write one, but there again, the central character is a South African in exile. But that's as near as I got to it. Now, I wouldn't really write. You know, I've said often enough that the thing about being in South Africa is that I can stand on a street corner in Cape Town, Johannesburg, anywhere, and just look at the passing parade of people and be fairly accurate in my imagined, what would you call it, my imagined story that goes along with either any of them, whether it's the old African lady with a shopping bag hurrying to catch the last bus back to the location, or whether it's a businessman driving past in his BMW or whatever. I can identify the stories that go with the faces that pass me on the pavement. I can't do that in America. I can't read an American crowd the way I can a South African.
Affle Fugard, it's been a great pleasure hosting you on People of Note. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Now on stage at Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay, a brand new, fresh and exciting production of Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice's wonderful musical, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Starring Earl Gregory as Joseph, Bianca LaGrange as the narrator, and Jonathan Rocksmith as the rock and rolling pharaoh. Now on stage at Peter Turin's Theatre on the Bay. Book now.